So, Dar, I got an email from Truth Out today, and is your latest piece, Climate Destruction in Overdrive, Submerged Cities and Melting That Feeds on Itself. Could you tell the listening audience a little bit about what you're putting across in that piece?
I will. There's a lot in this piece to discuss, so maybe I'll just talk about kind of the highlights, which many of which I touched on in the introduction of the piece, and then maybe you and I can go into some of the subsections a bit. But a lot of very, very intense information has come out over the last 30 days, and I do these dispatches just so that folks know I basically gather together all the most recent scientific reports as well as extreme weather events that have been tied to climate disruption. And so the first thing that I mentioned in this piece is a major study that just came out in the last month that shows the planet is warming 50 times faster than it does when it comes out of an ice age. So to think about how fast that warming is happening, that kind of the current warming of the planet is happening, that kind of gives us an idea of how fast it's actually happening. And that same study showed that even if we reach the politically agreed upon target of keeping global warming to below 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial baseline levels, sea level rise will still consume several major coastal cities around the globe. So, you know, I'm speaking with you. You're down there in Florida. It's interesting to know, and we talk about Florida specifically a little bit later on in the dispatch, but just by this study alone, it shows that one-fifth of the total world population that lives on the coastlines is going to have to migrate away from the coast. So cities, everything from Miami to New York, London, Rio, Jakarta, Cairo, Kolkata, and Shanghai, all of these cities are going to be underwater. And that's assuming we even keep the temperature below 2C, which is not going to happen. Which brings me to the next point, which is that NASA released recent data that showed that February, as in last month, was the warmest month ever measured globally. It was a full 1.57 degrees C above pre-industrial baseline. So again, we're talking about stopping the warming from getting to 2C. We're already well on our way there. It's also worth noting that record for the month smashed the previous high record, which was only the month before. So that gives you an idea of how fast things are progressing at this point. It's also worth noting that there was another study published in a journal called Nature Geoscience that revealed that carbon emissions are now the highest they've been since the age of the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. So it's also worth noting that the previous high level before us hitting this mark now was an event that occurred 56 million years ago that scientists believe was caused by the release of frozen greenhouse gases that were frozen into the seabed. It's also worth noting that we're already starting to see that now up in the Arctic and the tundra and the permafrost, where the melting is releasing those frozen stores into the atmosphere. So I think to close out my introduction here and kind of going back to a point I made just a moment ago, when we talk about how fast the temperature of the planet is now warming, it took, you know, according to this recent report, the one I mentioned that says that we're already, February was a full 1.57 degrees C above pre-industrial baseline temperatures. That means that it took from the advent of the industrial age until October of 2015 to warm the planet a full 1 degree C above pre-industrial baselines. And since that time, from October until now, 4 months, or rather until February, just that four-month period, we raised the planet's temperature another 0.57 degrees C. So in total, that brings us to the 1.57. So that gives you an idea of how intensely the human impact has been on the planet, to the point that we're ramping things up so fast at this point that even the scientists that are producing this data are shaking their heads.
They must be. It's incredible. So, So
it is. It is. And it also, you know, it's worth noting that, and there's more and more of these reports coming out now. I'm already working on next month's dispatch, but this 2°C goal that we talk about, you know, it's what we heard before the Paris Accord last fall, the big climate meeting in Paris, and the goal was that we have to keep the planetary temperature below 2°C. Well, that's a politically agreed upon goal. There's no science behind that goal whatsoever, and that gets lost in the mix when people talk about this. And so it's worth noting that NASA scientist James Hansen, who's been blowing the whistle on climate change since the 80s, he had a paper out along with several colleagues over 2 years ago that showed 1°C should be the scientifically proven point of no return, that once we hit 1°C, all these climate feedback loops kick in and we're not going to be able to turn them around, and we're basically set for catastrophic climate disruption. Well, we've already hit 1°C. We hit 1°C planetary-wide just before the Paris Accords even occurred. So other things to note that I mentioned in this dispatch, there were parts of the Arctic in February that were 29 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than the normal February. They were basically seeing June temperatures in the Arctic, but it was February. So that gives you an idea how fast things are moving along up there. We saw dozens and dozens of all-time temperature records set across many, many countries of Europe and Asia just in February alone. The winter of 2015-2016 was the warmest winter ever recorded since record-keeping began. I mean, we can just go on down a litany of really rather scary records that we're seeing set both across the United States and across the world altogether. So, I mean, I can keep going, but it really, you know, it kind of starts sounding like a dystopian sci-fi novel, but this is what's happening, you know. And it's also important to note that, you know, we're now well over 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, which is also the highest. We reached that level in early March, and it's the highest ever annual increase that we've seen of CO2 levels ever recorded. And that's according to another study published in the New Scientist. So, again, we look out there at all the indicators of how fast the planet's warming, and on every level that you look at, you can see very, very distressing signs that it's looking pretty bleak as far as how far along we already are.
Mm. Yeah, I know in the section under Earth, you talk about how the agricultural sector is in big trouble as crops are being impacted dramatically. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, I will. And I'm actually, that's my next story for Truth Out that I'm working on now, is going a lot deeper into that topic, because it's obviously very, very important, because we talk about crops being in trouble. One thing that I note is that there's numerous pollinating species, from hummingbirds to butterflies to bees particularly, that are all being impacted deleteriously from climate disruption. So they're not getting enough to eat, or the temperature changes are affecting them adversely enough that their populations are plummeting. So there's less pollinators. So that means big trouble for agriculture and for crops. And so, for example, there's been a study that came out that showed that food scarcity caused by climate change is going to cause at least 500,000 deaths across the world by 2050. And that's because of lower food production from effects like what I just spoke of, as well as things like drought and extreme weather events that are going to make having productive crops on an industrial scale level necessary to feed the global population. It's going to make that increasingly difficult as time goes on. So, you know, just another UN report showed that just the effects of having less pollinating species available now because of the negative impacts of climate change, that alone is going to cause hundreds of billions of dollars worth of loss of food crops across the planet. So there's numerous other issues, but you know, these are very, very big problems. I mean, if we start talking about the fact that, you know, we have to remember that with population growth, there's 225,000 people at the dinner table tonight that were not there last night. That means we are adding every 4.5 days 1 million people to the planet. And so in order to feed them, we have to consistently be increasing crop production. But instead, we're faced with loss of pollinating species, increasing incidence of drought and wildfires across the world, extreme weather events like flooding and cyclones and things like this. So all of this is working against this ever-present need to keep increasing crop production. So as you can see, these two things do not, it's not going to end well when these two things meet. So I think we have to get used to, you know, global food shortages and possibly even refugees crisis coming up out of that.
Yes, I know. I know you use ACD, which is the anthropogenic climate disruption. Could you just elaborate on that definition a little bit so the listeners know exactly what that means?
Sure, it is a bit of a mouthful, but I choose to use anthropogenic climate disruption as opposed to climate change or global warming because it is scientifically specific. And so I'm very, very conscious of the fact that writing about this topic in the United States, where there is such a strong denial movement, fossil fuel-funded denial movement, where the vast majority of our politicians refuse to accept the reality of climate disruption, despite it having nearly 100% scientific consensus. So I choose my terms very, very carefully. And so anthropogenic means human-caused. And climate disruption as opposed to climate change or global warming, because climate disruption is the most accurate statement or rather terminology, because climate change is climate's changing every microsecond of every day. That's just a fact, and it always has been and it always will be. But climate disruption is more accurate because what we've done by introducing so much CO2 and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere is we're literally disrupting the climate patterns. And so some areas it's getting dramatically hotter, some areas it's getting dramatically colder, and we're seeing these massive fibrillations in between the two extremes. And so that's why it's just simply a much more precise way to frame what we're talking about and really not leave any room for error.
I would like to read a couple of sentences here. For humans in the far north, ACD's impacts are even more obvious. Intensifying heat is threatening the way of life of the indigenous population in the Arctic. With the ice disappearing and temperatures continuing to rise, the life cycles and numbers of fish, marine mammals, caribou, and polar bears are being altered, which is causing indigenous communities to face food shortages. Could you elaborate on that a bit?
Well, that's right. It's worth noting that in the Arctic, I mean, you know, many of the listeners have probably heard this before, but the Arctic is often referred to as the canary in the coal mine of climate disruption because they're seeing dramatic temperature increases. You know, we talk about, well, when is the rest of the globe going to hit 2C warming? Well, the Arctic, there's villages up there that have already hit 8C. And so because of the way the climate system works, when we start warming the planet in general, that warming's the most evident first in the Arctic. And so imagine that where if, for example, there's one place called Fort Yukon, Alaska, which in Alaska, it's the place that holds the lowest temperature record of the state. The lowest recorded temperature ever recorded in Alaska was at Fort Yukon. Well, they're now regularly seeing temperatures of as much as 60 degrees above normal. So I know that, you know, people understand, okay, well, 60 degrees, that's a big temperature derivation above normal, and yet think about it if where you live, if it was right now 60 degrees above normal, wherever that is, whether that's where you are, does that mean it puts it up into the hundreds right now, even though we're only in late March? Or if you're in a place like the southwestern United States, does that, in the summertime, does it kick it up to 160? I mean, that, just to give you a little idea, to kind of bring that home and make that, you know, really show you how dramatic dramatic that really is. And it is dramatic up there. So you have entire villages that are basically on top of permafrost, and that permafrost is now completely melting out. And so they're having to relocate entire villages. And this is becoming common across the Arctic, not just here, but even in northern Siberia, across Russia. I'm talking about the entire global Arctic region. And so that's a problem. And then you look at, you know, food shortages, you know, like what you mentioned, when there's the marine mammals and caribou and polar bears, their habitats being either completely annihilated or dramatically altered. So that means less subsistence living for the indigenous population. So there's a food shortage issue. This is a major crisis in the Arctic. And then there's ongoing meetings now, international meetings of Arctic populations that are trying to figure out, okay, what are we going to do about this? And so, you know, we have federal funding, even here in the U.S., going to some of these villages up in Alaska that are having to be relocated entirely. And I think we have to get used to this is going to become a much more common occurrence. Like we're seeing those right on the boundaries of the Arctic, right on the low-lying villages right on the sea that are being eroded into the sea because of permafrost melting and rising sea levels and increasingly extreme storms. These are having to be moved, and that's going to become much more common, not just for the outlying villages, but for those that aren't even right on the sea anymore. So these are some of the problems that are happening right now in the Arctic.
Mm. Yeah, I know that the next section of your piece, you mentioned in Africa, at least 36 million people are facing hunger due to record high temperatures and drought.
And that ties in with what we were talking about earlier with the crop production for the global food supply, where, you know, that's just a case in point as an example of what I mentioned earlier, where whether it be lack of pollinator species or record high temperatures and drought or wildfires, there's numerous things that are impacting the global food system that it's going to be a problem. And again, you know, when we talk about, you know, water in the water section, you know, this is always usually the biggest section in my dispatches because this is the sector of the earth where it's the most obvious that the impacts of ACD are the most obvious. There's either extreme amounts of water like sea level rise or flooding, or there's far too little where we have droughts and that's impacting the food supply like we're seeing right now in Africa. So numerous other examples, you know, speaking of too much, global rainfall extremes continue to be escalating as a result of climate disruption. So there's another study that came out showing, look, you know, we have to get ready for more and more rain. And this is also just common basic physics. When you increase the temperature of the atmosphere, it can hold more moisture. And so we have a lot more moisture in the atmosphere. So that means we're going to have a lot more rainfall. And that's simply what's happening. And now we have more and more scientific studies coming out to back that up. Also in that section, we have another study showing the increasingly acidifying oceans, which is a huge, huge issue, where we have a fact that, you know, one-fourth of all the CO2 released from our activities is absorbed directly into the planet's oceans. It's changing the chemistry of the oceans. So we're having coral bleaching events. There's another study that came out and showed that the Great Barrier Reef in Australia now, even in the pristine parts of the reef that haven't already been impacted by acidification and bleaching events, which the bleaching is actually coming from the warming ocean temperatures, even the pristine parts of the Great Barrier Reef are now starting to bleach out because of increasing temperatures on top of the acidification that's just weakening the coral to where it can't grow as well as it used to. And in many places, it's starting to not be able to grow at all. So that's an issue, too, in this section. So it's really, again, you know, just to kind of close out that section, if we talk about the amount of people that are going to be impacted just by sea levels rising alone, I mentioned Florida earlier. Well, there was another study that came out in the journal Nature Climate Change that showed just the 3-foot sea level rise, which is the current Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change estimate of what can be expected worst case scenario by 2100, even though I think that's far, far too low. Just that level alone is going to cause 4 million Americans to basically have to abandon their homes. And so if you look at these numbers and kind of translate it into what's going on in Florida with a 6-foot sea level rise, which is now becoming what more and more scientists are estimating we're going to see by 2100 at the latest, just in Florida alone, that means 4 million people are going to leave their homes. So that kind of brings it home to a lot of folks there down there in your listening area, where not even to talk about hurricanes, not to talk about lack of freshwater availability or any of that kind of thing, but just sea level alone means that over 4 million people just in Florida, assuming a 6-foot sea level rise by 2100, are going to have to find another home.
Yes, I pulled up that piece that you had a link to in your piece on rising seas pull Fort Lauderdale, Florida's building boomtown, toward a bust. And it looked like the scientists there, who Karen Bolter, she had pointed to one property that was right near the on one of the canals. The property flooded 11 days last year, and she said by the late 2030s it could have water on its property 267 days per year. So that's just one property, and so it is dramatic. That isn't that far away. We're talking about 2030.
It's really not. And the other thing to keep in mind is that the reality of things have consistently outpaced the worst case predictions of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, whether we talk about sea level rise or global temperature index or the numbers of droughts or extreme weather events. I mean, we can literally choose every category that's in all of the IPCC reports that come out on average every 7 years. And see clearly that for the last several reports in a row that they have released, that their projections are not even their worst case scenario projections are not keeping a pace with reality. And sea level rises, I think, where, you know, we're really seeing that, and especially you guys down there in Florida are seeing that really, really dramatically. You know, and, you know, some of the stuff we talked about at the beginning of the program about increasing temperatures and the warming up, very, very dramatic examples of that. And sea level down there is, I think, where it's going to be the most evident in Florida, where, you know, some of the extreme predictions show that literally the vast majority of the state's going to be underwater. You know, if we look at Greenland melting completely, you know, and start even looking a little bit beyond 2100, you know, things get pretty intense. But just looking at even just the current projections of up to 6-foot sea level rise, I mean, I think that's enough to try to deal with and digest at present. We're seeing, you know, firsthand, you know, what that's going to look like. And I imagine there's quite a few people in Florida already at certain high tides seeing what it looks like even just right now, that, you know, you throw a hurricane on top of that and things are going to get pretty intense.
Right. We've been fortunate the last 10 years, hurricane-wise. So, mm-hmm. You know, so people have kind of been lulled to sleep as far as the possibilities of what could happen. Maybe we can go right to the last section, denial and reality. Could you like to speak a little bit about that?
Sure. I'll just run through that, you know, give some highlights out of that. You know, there was another report that came out in the last 30 days that documented specifically, giving names and numbers, that showed how the fossil fuel millionaires pumped over $100 million into Republican presidential super PACs. And this was even before the election campaign even started. But that basically translates into one out of every $3 that was donated to Republican candidates came from rich people who made all their money from fossil fuels. So that gives you an idea of why all the Republican candidates deny the existence of human-caused climate disruption. Follow the money, as we say in journalism. There was another report that came out, and this one I found rather shocking. It came out by a group called the Center for American Progress Action Fund that shows that 6 out of every 10 Americans are represented by someone in Congress who denies the reality of climate disruption. And according to that report, 59% of the Republican House caucus and 70% of Republicans in the Senate deny that climate disruption is real and human caused. So that means that according to the U.S. Census, of the roughly 350 million people in this country, or I'm sorry, it's 330 million, 202,800,000 Americans are represented by someone who is actually a denier of the existence of climate disruption. I thought that was rather telling. It also holds up. It's inversely proportional to recent polling data by Gallup that shows actually 64% of Americans are worried either a great deal or at least a fair amount about climate disruption. So that means it's the highest level of Americans recorded since 2008 that are concerned with climate disruption. So, it doesn't add up, right, that we have the majority of the people, an increasingly large number of Americans, now 64%, are quite concerned about climate disruption, and yet it's the opposite as far as representation in the Senate and Congress. So I found that to be kind of an interesting disparity there. And then, to kind of round out this section, there's been another study that came out of the University of Queensland that gave a very, very stark warning that said, yes, indeed, it does look as though global temperatures are probably going to be rising much faster than expected, possibly even breaching the 2C mark much sooner than predicted. We're already seeing that we're getting rather close to that. It's worth noting that during the Paris Climate Accords this past fall, they were making all these benchmarks and getting pledges from different countries with the effort of keeping us from reaching the global 2C mark by 2050. In reality, it looks like we might be breaching that mark by 2020, as in less than 4 years from now. So, another thing to keep in mind. And then, I close this piece with a rather depressing note that came in the form of a cruise ship, where for the first time ever, the Arctic Passage between the Atlantic and the Pacific, which big ships have rarely been able to use this because of Arctic sea ice, this summer is now going to be opened up to cruise liners. And there is a cruise ship set to make that passage this summer, carrying 900 people paying over $100,000 apiece to go through this route. And so it's again, back to the dystopian sci-fi movie where as the planet burns and the Arctic is melting, there's going to be tourists going up there for a first-hand view, riding a giant CO2-emitting cruise ship to see what's left of the Arctic and the dwindling sea ice for polar bears, paying, obviously this is some of the 1% that can afford to do a trip like this. So that kind of gives you an idea of where we're at. And I think, I guess the thing I would finish with this conversation with is it's all extremely depressing, very, very difficult information for us to take in, because it's really scary to think about the fact that this planet, which we completely depend upon for our lives, is in severe jeopardy right now. It's in big, big trouble, and all the signs indicate that things are going to get a lot worse. And I think it just really underscores the fact that we need to be very intentional about what we do and how we talk about this, and think about what's really, really important to us today and start behaving accordingly. I think that that's more important now than ever before. So I wouldn't go so far as to try to tell anybody what they should or shouldn't do, but I think each person needs to really look at their life, decide what is really, really important to me, and am I doing that thing or not? And I think that that's the level that we're at now as a species and how we need to start thinking so that we might behave a little bit more accordingly with what's actually happening.
Yeah, that's a good way to end it. I agree with that. I like the way you end that piece with the reality check. It's just so typical, the 1%. They have no concept, no idea of what's really important.